Welcome to the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Jamie Roger on the Chef in the Hat.
Yay, he's back. Folks, he's back. We'd love to hear that voice again, even if it's on the phone. Thank you for joining up again, Chef Thierry. We've got a big show today. We're going to talk spinach, and we're going to talk the cities we miss. You know, you and I have moved around the country a bit, and we're going to go to New Orleans today. We're going to talk cheesesteaks because there's an inauguration day coming up, and we're doing our fourth cheesesteak pop-up on the dock out at the Sirius Pie Takeout out there in Ballard. And so going to talk about that in honor of the Delaware Avenue cheesesteak, not the Philly cheesesteak. This is just 30 minutes south, and it's a better cheesesteak, if I do say so myself. And we're going to have a pass it down because we have a great story about Cornish pasties. And we want to hear your thoughts on ghost kitchens. I've been approached to do ghost kitchens around the country, and I've been kind of pushing it off. And as this pandemic wears on and people are ordering from home more and more and more, I'm wondering from you, listening to you, about your thoughts on ghost kitchens. Are you supporting them? How do you feel about them? This is my listeners that I'm talking about. Terry's my listeners. So we're going to have a segment there, and I'm going to have a little prize for anyone who gets online and goes to our Facebook page. Isn't that right, Amy? And tells us their thoughts about whether or not we should join up with this group to open ghost kitchens around the country.
That is correct. And our Facebook page is Hot Stove Radio Show.
There you go. Chef Brittany Bartleben in the Baker's Corner is going to be here. We are loving that. She's over at the Met Markets now instead of the Dahlia Bakery. But we're going to talk about some wintertime citrus fruits that can be used in your kitchen, like sumos and kumquats and things of that nature that seems to be this time of year. I know it's not really, when you think about it, wow, we have hot citrus fruits, but this is the time, even when the kings and queens of France and England and places in the wintertime would have these glass houses where they would have their own orangeries, right? Things like of that nature. She's also going to stick around for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Super exciting because Chef Terry, having to come to us from his home, is going to kick her butt because he has Google at his fingertips and we won't see him. So, Chef,
we'll see about that.
Huh?
We'll see about that.
We'll see about that.
She's pretty feisty. You know, Brittany's feisty.
You've had 6 weeks or so off. Tell our listeners what's going on in your world and that crazy bug that you're fighting.
Well, I got knocked with a little pneumonia in December that kind of kicked my butt. And went to the emergency room, actually. That was pretty bad. I basically did what you're not supposed to do, which is run myself to the ground.
Yeah.
So, taken care of. Beautiful, by the way. I want to give a shout-out to Kaiser, Drs. Pierre Chuang, and Mr. Cairns, Dr. Cairns, and Lensa Tiff, which they were super beautiful people, assistants. These people in the front line, we call them people in the front line, they're definitely on the front line. And you know, it's kind of crazy when you actually go to a hospital right now and see what's going on. It's not something you want to go see and get in the way, but being firsthand on the front line over there, that was pretty crazy to see their life. Those guys are very definitely double working right now and in a very scary surrounding. So
yeah,
kudos to all of them. And once again, thank you so much for staying in the front line. We need people in the front line, and I'm glad they're doing the job.
Yeah, and you went in for a more typical, like, you know, mostly they're dealing with COVID, but to deal with pneumonia, or some people have cancer, or some people have, you know, other diseases that have, you know, all we hear about is the COVID these days, but things like pneumonia, if you were to get COVID on top of pneumonia, you'd be in real trouble. So that's why you're...
I mean, definitely the danger of doubling up is not very cool, and it's the danger is definitely there. So yeah, that's why I'm at home quarantined right now, trying to stay away from people and making sure I'm not catching anything that I don't want to catch.
Yeah, exactly, because it's hard to fight it when you've got pneumonia.
But that said and done, I'm definitely on the front line of what's left in your fridge and cooking every day with Kathy. We both are like, we sit down and the first thing we go is, what are we going to have for dinner?
While you're having breakfast, right?
We just literally had that conversation this morning at breakfast. I'm like, okay, what's in the fridge? I got a little mushroom. I got some spinach, some broccoli, some bok choy. Last night we had a couple of pieces of I have a couple of frozen pieces of cod and halibut, you know, and every day. It's a beautiful little, I love it. I just love it. You know, it's like the game is finish the containers.
Right.
You know, it's really cool.
Well, I think that's fantastic. And it's also, it's just such a, you know, it kind of makes Jackie, my wife, a little bit crazy when I do that because she's not the best leftover eater. I can put together anything in my fridge and make a breakfast, lunch, or dinner out of it. I often stock my freezer, you know, with things like cabbage rolls or lamb mole. Or the other day, I had a 15-pound brisket on my barbecue. That's what I did on my day off. I made a huge brisket. And after we had a typical, you know, brisket with grits and a roasted sweet potato, then I had 10 pounds of brisket left to deal with. So I made brisket chili. I now have 20 pints of brisket chili in my freezer. And she looks at that and says, no way. I mean, that is, I should bring them in. I should bring them in and share them because she will never eat that much. She might eat one more pint in about 3 months, but she just doesn't go for the leftover thing like I do.
Well, yeah, I love leftovers. I think it's a thrill to me to use something that's already been used once, you've enjoyed, and now you got to enjoy it again. And most likely, well, you know, you're not going to make it exactly the same way. You're going to make something different. So it's really fun. I think it's what makes cooking so fun.
Yeah, and don't you think that's part of our restaurant training? Because when we bring in a salmon, let's say, and you get your 20 perfect portions for dinner
right.
service. And now you've got about 2 or 3 pounds of trim on a 20 right. pound salmon, maybe even more. And so you have to right. If you throw that away, your salmon, when you charge your customer for that salmon, if you only get the 20 portions and then you divide the cost of that salmon into the 20 portions, the price to the customer is going to be much higher if you don't use that trim. Now, if you turn that trim
correct.
And you make smoked salmon out of it, or you make, like we do, salmon burgers, or if I can spread right. that trim out and make more money on it, make salmon chowder, whatever it is, now yeah. I can bring the price of those 20 perfect portions down a dollar or two because I've utilized the whole fish. And so that's just something, it goes right back to what you're saying about emptying containers in your very own home fridge. It just is one of those things that we've learned in the business to make ourselves more successful. All right, we got to move on to our next segment. I'm so happy to have you back in the kitchen here at the Hot Stove, even if it's on the phone. Thank you for joining us. Carly Knowles, our fabulous new find here. Her book is called The Nutritionist Kitchen. She's going to come talk to us about spinach because I have a hankering for spinach almost every day. And so I want to know, is it like the lettuce lie or is there real value in eating spinach? That's up next on the Hot Stove Society show. It's Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. And we're back in the Hot Stove Society kitchen. It's the Hot Stove Society show on Cairo. I'm Tom Douglas. Chef Terry is on the line, but he's taking a hiatus for this segment because our phone lines don't match up with Carly Knowles, who you heard on this show a few weeks ago when she was introducing her book to the world, The Nutritionist Kitchen. And we were so impressed with her, we want her to become our go-to when it comes to nutrition. Are you up for that, Carly?
Oh, my gosh. I'm honored. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. How's Portland today?
You know, it's doing its thing. It's rainy and gloomy, and I love it.
It's funny. It's the same way Seattle is today.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, you know, I'm a big spinach nut, and I like it, and I crave it, just like I crave broccoli all the time. I even probably crave spinach more than I do broccoli because I think of different ways to do use spinach more so. So whether it's a little spinach souffle or whether it's just quick sauteed spinach, a spinach salad. For me, I don't love raw broccoli, but I'll eat raw spinach. I just crave it. And I was curious, Amy and I were talking about this when talking about favorite foods, and she wanted me to talk about chickpeas, which I do not crave. I'll eat them anymore, but I don't crave them. But spinach I do crave, and I wanted to know if it's part of the lettuce lie, and if you probably know what I'm talking about when I say that, or is it really good for us? And so we thought we would call you. Since you wrote this incredible book, The Nutritionist Kitchen.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for trusting me. I love that you crave. First of all, we just have to celebrate that. You crave spinach. Yay! All the nutritionists, dietitians were dancing. I also crave those greens, those leafy greens, especially the really dark leafy greens. That's kind of that distinction between some of those, like you say, the other lettuces, or, you know, when we think of like iceberg lettuce that has less nutrition than maybe some of those dark leafy greens.
Carly, wait a second. Just less or pretty much zero? Because they do call it the lettuce lie for a reason.
Well, so here, I'm not a person that likes to give these big ultimatums, like yes and no. I think some people only have access to that, okay? Because it lasts longer, they can package it more easily, more people crave it, so it's produced at a cheaper cost. So I don't ever want to say no, don't do something in the nutrition world. I like to just say there might be a better alternative. So for here, we could call it a lie, we could just say it has less. You pick your verbiage.
Oh, but, no, I'm going with you. Like, that's inclusive. Okay. I'm going with you.
I love dark leafy greens and spinach. I love that you crave it. Do you find that you crave it in certain seasons, or you crave it after certain times of the year? Talk to me.
Well, I crave it all year long, and I just love it. And so, like, when I go out to breakfast at the Bay Cafe down there in Fisherman's Terminal, I'll have a Greek omelet, and I'll, you know, and it'll be spinach and feta and mushrooms. And then when I'm cooking at home, or like our number one selling salad down at Seatown, or at I can't even get my restaurant straight. Etta's was always this spinach salad with crispy chunks of bacon, curried cashews, a little sesame dressing, and that was a regular kind of raw spinach salad. I love that salad, and I would then go home, and I like making quick little souffles out of pate de choux, and then pureed spinach or pureed ruby chard, or I love rebolita, which is a Tuscan bean and kale soup, which easily could have spinach in it. So I just like it in all ways. And when I was growing up, I had it oftentimes. My mother always bought it when I was growing up with eight siblings. You know, she bought frozen boxes of spinach. And every other kid in our house, she had to kind of force, you know, you have to put some on your plate and you have to try it. Me, I would eat the whole box. And it's just always been in my system. I like it.
Oh, I love it. Well, I think that's really cool. And something really noteworthy about spinach that maybe is worth celebrating more than other greens, as we've pointed out, is the iron content. So that's something I wonder too, you know, when I hear a patient of mine or a friend, family member say they are craving something and it's not, you know, a cookie or something with sugar and fat that might be more traditionally craved, I like to look at the nutrient content. And one of the things that spinach has is iron, because sometimes when we crave that, our body's asking us for more of that nutrient, not always, but that's something that separates this cool leafy green. There's tons of iron and folate, B vitamins, vitamin A, vitamin C, it goes on and on and on. But iron's kind of special because normally we find that in animal protein, right? Like seafood and meat. But spinach has a lot of iron, so cool.
There's a lot of spinach out there in the marketplace, and I'm not sure if you delve into this idea or not, but so there's the spinach that comes in a bunch. It's a little bit larger. There's the spinach that comes in the little salad packs that is big, what they call baby spinach. Is there a version of spinach that is more special than another from a nutrient standpoint?
You know, that's a great question. I think there's less research in that area. Or less research that I am aware of is probably the better answer. Where I know we can affect the nutrient content in our spinach is more in how we prepare the spinach. Something just to note, though, often research points to when we have a younger form of a plant, specifically produce, so like the baby spinach you mentioned, oftentimes there will be more nutrients in the younger form because it hasn't been exposed to the elements for as long or stored somewhere as long, you know, reducing some of its nutrients. But mostly I know how the way we cook it or don't cook it affects spinach.
Well, that amazes me. My instinct would be, like, for example, black cod, right? When it's only a 1 to 3 pound fish, it has very little fat content. It's just not as good. When it gets into that 3 to 5 pound area, it becomes that luscious butterfish and has so much more omega-3s. And, of course, it has to get older in order to do that. So I just assumed, you know, obviously wrongly, that the older and bigger the leaf, the probably the better it was for you. And so I'm totally wrong.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. They, in some preliminary research, so again, very young research in the research world, when they look at like sprouts, you know, like the sprouts people put on their sandwiches or eat on salads, when they grow sprouts and test the nutrient content of many types of sprouts, like broccoli sprouts, for example, they find that there's almost the same amount of nutrients in the small sprout as it is in the full plant. So again, we need a little more research before we can like scream this from the top of the mountain, but there's a lot of ideas out there that we're actually just increasing the amount of foliage we have to eat for the same amount of nutrients. So it's pretty cool to think about that and how we, you know, in a way they're born with everything they need, which is a cool concept.
Mm-hmm. And then one last thing on spinach. We only have a minute, but I've read articles where guys like me who don't often give blood or, you know, aren't going to go to the doctor very often, when we eat a lot of iron, like that, what you find in spinach, is that we can get out of whack. Is that true?
When you say out of whack, I'm assuming you're meaning like you'll have an iron overload.
Yes, exactly.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think it would take you a lot of spinach to do that. So what's really cool is when we eat food versus supplementing, it's a lot harder to overdose on a nutrient. So I'll say that if you had some sort of baseline health condition that you needed to reduce your iron for whatever reason, then that person might need to watch their iron intake. But for the average American, for the average healthy adult, I think if you're eating those things in food form, you should be absolutely okay.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I can live my spinach miracle every day then.
You can, Popeye. Yes, you can.
I'm so happy, Olive. Olive oil. Carly Knowles has been my guest. She's the author of The New Nutritionist Kitchen, and it's become a little bit of a Bible for me because I'm not trying to be more healthy in a funny way. I'm trying to understand what it is that I eat in a better way. Because
yeah,
I come at it with the ignorance of information, but I know what I love and what I eat and how I cook it and all that sort of thing. So I just want to complete the circle on the foods that I love to eat.
I love to hear that. Yeah, we're just turning up the notch, right?
Yep.
We just have a volume dial and we're just turning it up a notch. Yep.
All right. Love go it. Out and get her book, The Nutritionist Kitchen. It's really awesome. And Carly Knowles is her name. And thank you for joining us from Portland, Carly.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye. All right. Up next, it's The Cities We Miss. Chef Terry's going to get back on the line, and we're going to talk about New Orleans because we've got a couple of things coming up at the dock out in Ballard that might be a fun little hit for y'all. I'm Tom Douglas. Chef in the Chapeau is joining me on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rocher, the chef in a hat from home.
Coming to us from his home in Madison Valley. If you want to stalk him, he'll throw tomatoes at you from his windows. Let's see, Chef, we've started this series a bit ago in response to not being able to travel very much. We started thinking about cities and what we kind of miss and what will be the first thing when we get back there and start traveling again, the first restaurants that we might head to based on where we have been in our past lives, the pre-COVID lives. Let's jump into New Orleans. You know, I've got a pop-up coming this next week based on New Orleans, so we thought we would go back there in our minds. The pop-up is a dinner and demo at the Hot Stove Society by me. It's from an old book from an old friend, Paul Prudhomme, from his Louisiana kitchen called K. Paul's. And I remember going there many, many years ago and sitting at the communal tables and just getting these outrageously large plates of really heavy, heavy, heavy food in every course. And there was a reason why he was 4 foot tall and 4 foot wide at that time, because that's the nature of that food. And I would see Paul out at the shows. You know, I had my rub line and he had his Cajun magic line, and we would be at all the fancy food shows together, and he'd just sit on his chair. And then over the last 15 years of his life, 10 years of his life, you know, especially after his wife died of obesity, and he was being threatened himself because of health, you know, he started to, every time I would see him, he'd be like less of the man that I remembered. And finally, he got pretty skinny before he passed.
Yeah.
But so I remember, and I think about that setting just because of COVID and all the tables there were communal, just like all the tables at Sirius Pie here in downtown were communal at the time. And we're not going to be able to do that anymore. People just aren't going to, I don't feel people are going to do that. So we're going to think about right. how we're going to rearrange our dining room. What's your favorite memory of New Orleans?
Well, my last trip to New Orleans, which was about a year and a half ago, was I went to this restaurant called Louvie, L-U-V-I, which was a it's like a Chinese, the chef is Chinese American, and really beautiful food, clean flavors, and almost like a Chinese with a hint of Japanese in it in presentation, and really beautiful garnishes, but the flavor of the food was really nice. It was super clean and very on top of, I mean, one of the things that I remember having was a cold dish of tuna, caviar, and a smoked soy sauce. Now, at first, I was like, oh, what is this is going to be like? If this is not done right, this could be awful. You know, I mean, soy sauce, caviar, and tuna, I'm like, it could be overwhelming. It was so delicate and so beautiful. I was really, really impressed by that. The balance was beautiful. Lightly smoke on the soy, and you could taste it, and that was pretty impressive. I was very, I learned something, because mm-hmm. I never thought about smoking soy sauce, I can tell you that. And I also had some bum bum chicken, which is, it's traditional, you know, fried chicken, but it was really well done. The fry itself was so beautiful and light, almost like a tempura, but much more, how would you say, more body to it, but not heavy body.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, crispy skin. It was beautiful. The fish there was absolutely fantastic. This guy does a beautiful job. I recommend if you go to New Orleans to do a stop there. The other restaurant is called Coquette, C-O-Q-U-E-T-T-E, which means cute in French. And
so when somebody is coquettish, they're cute.
Yeah, very cute. I haven't been to Coquette, but to one of my ex-employees, Laura, who was managing at the Luc, has moved with a friend to New Orleans, and a friend who was a chef at Locke, Kylie. So they moved down to New Orleans, and Kylie is working at Coquette, and I can't wait to get back to New Orleans and try that. Kelsey, and it's not Kylie, Kelsey.
Yeah.
And that's another place I want to try. But I also remember my trip to Galatoire. Last time I was there, these folks who had bought this auction item at Food Lifeline was for me to go down there and cook for 10 people, and they take me to Galatoire, and what a walk into a ancient place.
Mm-hmm.
It was so traditionally classic, and you know, keeping some of the old-fashioned 1950s style of restaurant, French restaurant kind of idea, mixed with it's time to dust the place and you know move on and bring it up to date a little bit. It was very dated. The food was good. It was good for what it was, but it was not, I think it needed to be brought up a little bit.
Yeah. You know, when I went to try to go to Galatoire's or Antoine's in New Orleans, I got booted from both places because I wasn't dressed properly. So I can't review those. I can't review those restaurants.
That sounds so silly for New Orleans.
I know.
The French Quarter.
You know, the humidity is about 1,000% and the temperature is about 150 degrees and they want me to have a coat and tie on. It's like, no, I'm not a chance. I'm not doing it.
No.
I'd rather not eat here. And so I didn't. And I feel like I'm the loser in that scenario.
You're the loser, yes, but it's kind of silly. But
it is kind of silly.
Also, I don't want to forget to mention Bayona. Susan Spicer,
yeah.
She's still doing good. She's still cranking and, you know, she's still doing it. But that restaurant is delicious. She has a beautiful hand on a local tech on modern New Orleans, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So you would call it. But she does a beautiful job. So that's another restaurant to recommend in New Orleans.
You know, and I like the fact that she's also stayed relevant in the food world. You know, she fights for sustainability. She fights for farm to table. She has always kept a nice voice when it comes to how we should be running business and you know, sustainability and things like that, too. So I appreciate
that. Good person.
Yeah. When I go,
so what about you?
Yeah, I'm. Well, you know, everyone goes to Café du Monde, and I just think that that is a place that is a place for all people, and you can dress any way you want, and I you have to take a little stroll through Café du Monde. Central Grocery, the Muffaletta at Central Grocery, is really. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a prime example of what it should be. You know, to me, that's how I learned how to make muffaletta. Now, whether you like it or not is really not important so much as that is what they can, you know, they are most well known and they've been made muffaletta famous, and that is what it is there. So, it's a little bit like a Cubano in Miami. You know, the Cubanos didn't originate in Cuba. They originated, I think, from what I understand, in Miami. And so, people imitating flavors from where they had come from. So I love the Central Grocery for that reason. You know, I have such fond memories of taking my mother-in-law for her 60th birthday to Emeril's. And at the time, Emeril was just getting started on the Food Network. We had done events around the country together as peers, as, you know, chefs that did events through the American Institute of Food and Wine and places like that. And he had an open kitchen, and he sat us at his open kitchen where he cooked for my mother-in-law, and she just swooned. She was every fan that he has ever had, that she was just bowled over. And then he wouldn't charge us for dinner and all that sort of thing, and it was just it was a super fun night, and I remember that tremendously. I would go back to Emeril's in a second. I don't imagine he'll be cooking behind the counter the next time I'm there.
I was at Emeril the weekend, and the Super Bowl was in New Orleans 1 year.
Uh-huh.
That's like 15 years ago, probably. That was definitely a trip, and Emeril was there too. He was cooking away.
He's such a nice guy, and has been.
Oh, yeah.
You know, over his entire, you know, since I've known him, when he was too shy to even speak in public, until he became a superstar in the Food Network. So, Terry, I just want to tell folks about a couple of New Orleans things that we're doing. I'm doing dinner and a demo here at the Hot Stove Society, which is January 21st. So if you want, I'm going to cook from Emeril's, Paul's book, Paul Prudhomme's Louisiana Kitchen. And then we're also going to do the food box that you can pick up and order either the ingredients or dinner if you want to cook along, or you can buy the is that right, Amy? Can they buy the ingredients and dinner, or just the dinner to eat along with us?
For your class at Hot Stove, it's dinner and a demo. So
dinner
most
and a demo. So you can buy the dinner and then sit and eat dinner while I demo all the recipes. And there's some interesting things about Cape Hall, the restaurant. And, you know, Paul Prudhomme is the one who brought us really the dark roux and the barbecued shrimp and a lot of the fun stuff. I know I'm doing smothered rabbit, I believe, that night. Or did you choose the chicken and dumplings?
I chose the chicken and dumplings.
Oh, listen to you.
Mm. Uh-huh. But you're doing crawfish. That's cool.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that dish?
The crawfish etouffee?
Magnifique.
Oh, it's done in that what are those called? Merlins. Mm. And it's kind of a tight-skinned little, almost looks like an avocado, like a light green avocado, and they get the pan-fried or blanched, and then I'm stuffing the Merlin with the crawfish.
Sounds so
cool. I know it's going to be fun. And then next week, we are at our Serious Takeout. We're making gumbo. So our dinner box, like this week, our dinner box is French onion soup. Mm-hmm. Next week, our dinner box is going to be a gumbo dinner box with cheddar jalapeno hush puppies, chicken shrimp and andouille gumbo, pecan pie, you name it. A cocktail we're throwing in there, like a Sazerac cocktail. So it's going to be super fun. So up next, it's Inauguration Day coming up, and we're going to do some Delaware Avenue cheesesteaks for Inauguration Day. Let's talk about what makes a good cheesesteak and why I won't be doing a Philadelphia cheesecake. On Cairo Radio, it's Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. Chef Tom Douglas and the Chef in the Chapeau coming to us from his home, where he's in pneumonia quarantine.
Yes, it's a new place called pneumonia quarantine.
Pneumonia quarantine. And just so people know, you just can't be, you know, if you were to get COVID or something like this on top of your pneumonia, then that would not be good. So that's why you're just staying home and staying safe and calling us on the line here. Anyway, let's get started on my next subject, which I don't know. Sometimes I think people think that I'm an egomaniac because when I like or dislike things, I'm pretty adamant about it. And I don't mean to be an egomaniac. I just have an opinion, right, Chef? You have an opinion on things. I just have an opinion. And my opinion is that Philadelphia should give up the cheesesteak crown in the world because they have let it get out of control, and that now, more than ever before, they encourage people to put dairy-less whiz on top of their cheesesteaks and somehow or another make people think that that is the cool in thing to do. Like, you're part of the in crowd if you know how to say wit whiz. And here's what I got to say with that. Without whiz is what I got to say. I want real cheese on my cheesesteak. And so in order to get a real cheesesteak without having to be pressured into wit whiz, you need to move down I-95 corridor into Delaware, into Wilmington, Delaware, and check out the Delaware Avenue cheesesteaks, like in Claymont, Delaware, or the old Park Deli, which is now closed in Newark, Delaware, or Daffy's Deli in right by the freeway, 896 freeway on I-95 there in Delaware. So there's a lot of consternation about me. The people around me, are you sure you want to trash the Philadelphia cheesesteak? People love it. I know they love it. I'm just kidding. It's
so, Tom,
fine. Yes.
How about a refresher on what actually goes into a cheese steak?
Well, you know, Chef, if you had ever come to one of my pop-ups out at the dock where I do cheesesteaks, which I'm doing on Inauguration Day, although now since you're in pneumonia hell right now, I'm going to have to deliver cheesesteaks to your door. Although they don't cheesesteaks.
It's okay. I can send someone.
Yeah, the cheesesteaks do not travel super well because they're a hot, greasy mess, and they kind of want to soak through the bun pretty quickly. So they're the kind of thing you kind of have to almost burn your mouth on. And Amy, I'm going to have you talk for a second. Amy's our producer today. And talk for a second about your first cheesesteak experience on the dock out in Ballard and what you thought about it.
Well, my first cheesesteak experience was here at Hot Stove when you were demoing it for Evening.
Oh, Evening Magazine, or Evening Show, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I tasted it, and you know me, it's not something I normally would eat, and it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the technique that you sautéed the peppers first, or was it the steak, and then the peppers, and then put the cheese on, and it kind of steamed together, and then placed the bun right on top.
Mm-hmm.
So then we thought we'd do a pop-up, and we were slamming.
It sold out in a few hours. Yeah,
yeah, we've sold out for all four of our pop-ups so far. They're delicious.
And they're a unique texture and taste at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like how crispy the beef is and how it's kind of cut up into little pieces. Mm-hmm. You added mushrooms to yours, which I thought was great.
I know they would never do that in Philly unless you ordered a mushroom cheesesteak.
I would do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way I like it.
And that usually gets me in trouble with people because I'm getting in the middle.
What kind of cheese?
Provolone.
Okay, good.
And the concession I make is I use domestic provolone style cheese. I don't even like to call it provolone because to me that has to come from a certain area of Italy. But a lot of local companies make provolone style cheese, and it's real melty, but it's real cheese. It has real dairy in it, and it's not Velveeta,
which is
basically Cheese Whiz is a version of Velveeta, the way I look at it. So, that's how they're made.
If you make it, so first thing, obviously, I know that you're going to say yes to that. You have to make sure you crisp your roll really well
and
on the griddle.
I do. I toast it on both the outside and, you know, the top and the bottom, but not on the inside. It's not like sometimes, you know, how you want a butter toasted bun and you crisp in the inside. That's not the way it goes for a cheesesteak. You want that inside kind of sticky and steamy and spongy a little bit, and that's the classic
really?
Philly style of hoagie roll, where you get that kind of little bit of a crunchy outside and that that real kind of creamy inside.
Cool. And then what's the spread that's going to go on there? Is it mayo?
So I, again, this is what makes it a Delaware Avenue cheesesteak rather than downtown Philly. I make a aioli, like a classic garlic mayonnaise, and then I put my veggie rub in it, which has got fennel and toasted garlic and toasted onion. And so I make like a garlic fennel aioli for the bun.
That sounds good.
Yeah, and then I also use that on my cheesesteak. So one of the things that people try to do with cheesesteaks is they try to fancy them up too much, and you really have to use the cheap thinly sliced. It's almost chopped and reformed cheesesteak steak out of the Philadelphia area. It's called Old Philly Cheesesteak or something like that. And the reason you have to use that is that it's trashy. It's 25% water solution. And people think, you know, God, I don't want all that, you know, fake water or dextrose or whatever it is that's in there. But that's part of the cooking process. When you put that frozen cheesesteak onto the griddle, it's super thin, like, you know, less than a 16th inch thick. And that water turns and dextrose turns into steam and browning on your meat. And that is part of the flavor profile and part of how it cooks. And that's why your cheesesteak meat cooks in 2 or 3 minutes, even from rock solid frozen, because it's super thin and it's full of this dextrose compound that makes it steam right on the griddle. And that's why when I'm out there doing it for 8 hours in a row, I get a beef facial every time. I can only do five at a time, and I get all this beef steam in my face at the same time. And my poor mask, when I have to wear my mask. Oh, my God.
Tom, is that why all the dogs in the neighborhood was following you when you left?
Exactly. It was almost like I had bacon in my pocket, except I smelled like a big old cheesesteak. So I toast the bun on both sides.
What about caramelized onion? Do you do that too?
I do. They come out better. I was doing them every time with every cheesesteak, and they weren't cooking enough for me. So now I caramelize the onions, the red peppers, the green peppers, and the mushrooms all in a big batch on my griddle. And I make enough for each time slot because we can only do 15 sandwiches every 15 minutes, a sandwich a minute. So I just make batches, and it works out much better, and the product comes out good. But the important part is that melty cheese, which ties everything together, right, Amy? Mm-hmm. That cheese just kind of drips through all the meat and the peppers and the onions, and you get this big, luscious, drippy, greasy, grimy gopher guts cheesesteak sandwich.
Yeah, with little crispy bits.
Crispy bits in it. And it's super, super fun, super delicious. I have a great time out there on the dock. And there's a lot of people from Philly that come by. You know, there's a lot of people that just have never had a cheesesteak that come by.
Some come for the facials.
Some come to watch me get a facial. It's a good time had by all. If you want to come in.
What are you drinking with that?
Whiskey. I'm a whiskey guy on the griddle, so. Red wine's a little too sophisticated for a cheesesteak day.
Yeah, it's a bit too nice.
Just so you know, I'm doing since Joe Biden is from Delaware, I'm doing a Delaware Avenue cheesesteak pop-up on Inauguration Day from 11:30 to a.m. to 7 p.m. out at our dock at 57th and 14th Northwest. So
you're going to be sold out.
I hope so. It's super fun. I seriously get my butt kicked on the griddle. So I have a 6-foot griddle now, Terry, that does propane fired, and I'm out there cooking as fast as I can cook, which, according to some people, isn't all that fast. Like Amy says that to me. Said, can you pick up the pace a little bit, Tom?
Come on.
Can you pick up the pace? You're falling behind. Up next, it's hour number two. We've got a big show. Terry's going to... be the first time he says he's going to kick Brittany Bartleben's butt here in the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. And of course we have Brittany and our Pass It Down segment on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Hot Stove Society show. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society show, hour number two. We're happy to have you. Thanks for listening in. Remember, if you can't find us live because of a sporting event or something like that, you can always download us, right, Amy?
You can at our podcast, Hot Stove Society show.
All right. And that's on the Cairo Radio app or your favorite podcast station.
Wherever.
Where do you get your podcast from?
I do Stitcher.
You do Stitcher.
Yeah. Okay.
That is the voice of Chef Brittany Bartleben. She's going to join us for the second hour, along with Chef in the Chapeau. Welcome, Chef.
Pleasure being here for the second hour, Tom.
Exactly. Chef is in some pneumonia quarantine. He's quarantining himself so he doesn't get anything on top of it. And so he's going to be coming to us by phone for a few weeks. We're looking forward to that. Much better than not having you here at all there, Chefy.
Yes, and it's nice to just wear the mask and stay home.
Yeah, exactly. All right, in this hour, we're going to talk to our listener, Linda Stanley's mom, about listener Linda Stanley's mom's recipe for Cornish pasties in our Pass It Down segment. I want to hear your thoughts about ghost kitchens. We have been approached by a company to do maybe 50 ghost kitchens around the country, and I'm uncertain about it. So I'm curious, the people out there that are ordering from these online kitchens that have no retail presence, that's what a ghost kitchen is, right? They don't have a brick-and-mortar presence. Basically, they have a website, and they offer certain things from the menu on the website. And it looks like a restaurant, feels like a restaurant. You order from it like a restaurant, but it's really just a online kitchen. And that kitchen might host 10 different menus from 10 different concepts. And I'm curious what folks are thinking about that in this age of COVID and delivery food. As you know, Chef Brittany Bartleben is here to talk about the Baker's Corner and beautiful citrus. We've got some sumos and some kumquats coming up. What the heck do we do with those? And lastly, our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge is back, brought to you by Rub with Love and our Rub with Love online shop, the perfect spot to spice up your pantry. First, let's jump into Cornish pasties. Amy, our producer, you were on the line with Linda Stanley?
Yes, we shared a few emails together.
Good.
Yeah. So she turned in her mom's recipe, and this is the most popular traditional recipe in her family, and it's been handed down from generation to generation. They learned by working alongside her grandmother in the kitchen, and she just put this recipe into words for her younger generation. Her first memory was the amazing way the home smelled. She loved the smell of the roasting rutabagas. But her questions...
Now there, that's interesting right there, isn't it? Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Her questions, well, she wanted to ask...
This is not your typical household where you smell rutabaga roasting.
She wanted to ask Tom and Terry if you've ever eaten a pasty in Cornwall, and if they contained the same ingredients as her recipe. Her recipe contains beef, potato, rutabagas, and green onions. And she wants to know if you have a suggestion on making a better crust. Her crust wasn't as sturdy, but it tasted like cardboard.
The crust that she made wasn't as sturdy as her grandma's.
Yeah.
But her grandma's tasted like cardboard because it was so firm, right?
Yeah, so right now she's using a Pillsbury pie crust. So what can we do with that?
What can we do? Well, I'll just say for 1 minute to introduce this segment a little bit more, which is we've encouraged people to kind of get online, get to our website, and talk to you, Amy, and tell us about these recipes because, like we say here at the Hot Stove, a recipe isn't just a list of ingredients and a list of instructions. It's really a photograph into your life history, you know, how you grew up, the favorite family meals at Christmas, whatever that recipe is that you said. Well, this is a turns out to be the favorite one from her whole family. And passing it down isn't just passing down a little 3x5 index card. It's passing down why it was important in the family, right? So, you know, pasties originally were for to-go food for the miners, just like jerky was, or, you know, hardtack, you know, what they used to say, the hard biscuits out here in the West when they were traveling, right? So that's what these kinds of foods are about. I think the dough is tough for a reason. When I have been in Cornwall, I have had pasties there. And you go into any butcher shop, same way all throughout England and the UK. Up in Scotland, I go to a favorite shop in the little town of North Berwick. They have a great little butcher there. And you'll see these meat pies lined up in, and they're, as is the case with a lot of places in England right now, they're not homemade by the butcher. There's companies that make meat pies now that it distribute to all the butcher shops, right? It's just something that is mass-produced and sold. But they are made with lard. Those, these crusts are made heavy and hard with lard, and they're intended to be really a full meal between the filling and the crust. It makes a real full meal. Brittany, is there something that you would do to maybe tenderize it a little bit so you're not getting all the way to a fall-apart Pillsbury dough, but you can still not maybe need to be what Grandma used to make?
Yeah, I would sneak in a different fat, an alternative fat. Butter would be my first choice, but cream cheese is also a great idea. It adds more flavor. It tenderizes, it makes it flaky, but it's if you just do a little bit, the beauty of cream cheese is it makes a dough really easy to work with. Mm-hmm. And you don't want your dough breaking apart while you're trying to work with them, especially in what I'm guessing is a fairly wet filling. And that's the idea behind these doughs originally, is they need to be sturdy enough to hold the filling in there without them leaking everywhere. So like, for instance, an all butter pie dough is not going to be sturdy enough. No. It's much too tender. So you do want the lard in there, but sneak in a little bit more flavor so it doesn't taste like cardboard. I would even recommend just a tablespoon of sugar, few teaspoons of sugar.
Some dried herbs?
Some dried herbs, yes, yeah.
Black pepper?
Black pepper, something to pump up that flavor a little bit so you're not just tasting the lard and flour.
The flour, yeah. And then when you say add cream cheese, and let's just, I don't know what her recipe calls for exactly, but let's just say it has a quarter cup of lard.
Mm-hmm.
Would you just replace lard, or does it replace some of the moisture that you're, some of the water that you're adding? Like, do you just... 1-to-1, a quarter cup of cream cheese to the quarter cup of lard?
I would do just a couple of tablespoons, and yes, I would replace the lard with that. So
okay.
You still have lard in there, but you're adding a little bit of cream cheese instead.
But it doesn't take the place of anything else,
no.
Any other moisture, anything
no.
else. It's just
mm-mm.
another fat.
Yes.
And let's be clear, cream cheese, I know people like to think of it as cheese. It's fat.
It's fat. It's pure fat. It's delicious, pure fat.
Right, it's
yeah.
cream.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chef, how do you feel about that? Have you had a pasty?
I like the idea that Brittany is suggesting of the cream cheese, but I also like the idea of the butter versus lard. I think it's a completely different texture in the end. It would definitely, the lard, the problem with the lard is the moisture is not there, so it's very, you know, it's very,
very dry dense. Yeah.
In itself when it bakes. So it makes for a very solid crust, but sometimes too solid. So, yeah, just add some fat. I mean, if you wanted to make like a pot brisé, you could almost put an egg in there too. That would help moisture, and it would still keep it dry, and you know, the yolk would keep it dry. So there's a few tricks around, but I would suggest trying a couple of those next time she makes a batch of that dish, to make a couple of those and try them differently, see what the reaction is with the dish. Because the trick of this is she's trying to keep it in the dough so it doesn't soften down and break down, so after it's baked. So that's the challenge right there. So that's, I would try a few different doughs, one with butter, one with maybe eggs and butter, and one with cream cheese. I think those are good suggestions.
Amy, do you think Linda's got her answers?
I think she does. I think that's really helpful. I can't wait to talk to her after
I know
this.
It's going to be fun to hear. We love these thoughts from your family's history, so please get online and share them with us, and we'll get them on here onto the Hot Stove Show. Up next, I want to hear your thoughts on ghost kitchens, and we'll talk a little bit about what they are and why I'm interested, and the little prize that I'm going to give you for sharing your thoughts. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in the hat from home.
And we are happy to be joined this hour by Brittany Bartleben.
Hello.
And do you like Bartleben or do you like Adams? Which is your married name?
My married name is Bartleben.
Oh.
Yes. So my email is Adams. For some reason, changing that is too difficult for me. So I just like to confuse people.
I always thought it was the other way around.
No,
I was just.
No. I went and took the really long mouthful of a last name.
There you did. But Chef Brittany Bartleben is here. She's pastry chef over at the Metropolitan Markets, formerly Dahlia Lounge. Chef Rotero, I've been approached to do some ghost kitchens. There's a company that is going to open 50 big kitchens around the country that have no retail presence, right? You can't just drive up and go get a chair. You can't drive up, even grab to go. It's all delivery. And they really want my pizza concept, let's just say. And each of these kitchens have 16 different restaurants represented on their website, none of them having any brick-and-mortar space at all, right? So it's just something you look at the website, hey, it's Tom's Pizza. And you might think that it's a restaurant, but it's really just a 350-square-foot kitchen in this batch of restaurant kitchens that are all serviced online and with a delivery company that has beverages and stuff like that. Terry, I'm going to start with you. What do you think about this concept, this ghost kitchen? You know, they're happening all over the country. And during COVID, when people have been ordering delivery, they've become very popular. But I'm just not sure about them. How do you feel about them?
Well, I think that this the present time is definitely suited for such behavior. I mean, ghost kitchen, if it's done well, can be, it's professional chef cooking in a warehouse, which is not any different than cooking in a kitchen. It's still a professional kitchen, putting some good food out. I mean, I would totally trust you to do some very good work. I mean, this is what you do at the dock, more or less. It's every week you're doing a new restaurant.
Right.
A new style.
With our pop-up boxes, you mean, yeah.
It's not any different than that. It's just that your name may not be on the front door every time. That's a different story. But in terms of the food itself, and in the situation we're in right now with all these people ordering food all the time, very heavily in the last few months, obviously that's a no-brainer, then it's a good idea. My thought is that I still think that people are languishing to get back into the romanticism of restaurants, into the socialism of restaurants. You know, there's a huge part of our society that loves going to restaurants, whether it's a small cafe with a in the morning for breakfast or a fancy restaurant at night or everything in between. That still is something that people have as part of their life. Now, you know, a year down the line of COVID, people have definitely changed their habit. They have definitely changed their mentality on top of what's priority, what's not priority, what, you know, some things have fallen to the side. But I still think that people love the getting together into a restaurant. I think there is something that is part of a society that's been ingrained that is not about to change tomorrow, COVID or no COVID. Once COVID is gone, which it will be one day, hopefully, and I think that we're still going to need restaurants to be around. So I think there is a word for both. It's just the size of it sounds a little bit scary, but that's probably a scale of business that I'm not necessarily into
right.
or necessarily understanding. But other than that, I think Ghost Kitchen is not any different. I mean, there are some great caterers out there doing beautiful work.
Yeah.
They've always been and they will always be. So it's not much different than that in some ways. You just don't have, like you say, you don't have Thierry Rotiro or Tom Douglas or whatever. You don't have a name in front of it. That's not always necessary to produce good food.
Some people prefer that my name's not on it. Chef Bartolomeo, what do you think about a ghost kitchen?
As a consumer, I'm into it.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, I'm sick of the same delivery I've been doing. And so, I think it, like Thierry says, it's a great idea right now. However, we're not going to be in this situation forever.
Right.
And when restaurants reopen, I'm there. That's where I'm going to get my food.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not.
You're going to go out to eat, sit down, have someone else do the dishes.
Exactly. And listen to the clatter of the kitchen, uh-huh. which is, it's little things like that I really miss.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, once COVID's over and restaurants are back in their full strength, I'm not going to be doing this takeout thing anymore. And I realize that was a way people were starting to eat before this happened.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
I'm a restaurant gal.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. So the idea, just to be even more clear, is that let's just say we come up with a name, General Tom's Kitchen, and that's the website,
uh-huh.
right? And when you go to General Tom's Kitchens, plural, you look under the dumpling menu, or you look under the lovely dumplings, and then maybe there's five different literal, it looks like five different restaurants, mm-hmm. but it's all made by the same cooks out of the same kitchen. And does that fool you in a way mentally? Does that, do you understand what's really happening and you don't mind it?
Yeah, I don't
or
mind
does it.
It
bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me at all.
Okay.
I'd be kind of into it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even though it's the same cooks in the same
yep.
square footage
yep.
and one guy's making, you know, one menu is a Chinese restaurant and the other menu is a Mexican restaurant,
yeah.
you don't care that
don't
it's
care.
Not real in a way.
If they're good cooks making quality products and with good ingredients,
uh-huh.
I'm into it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So for you, our listeners, I'm curious about your opinion on this. For me, I have a hard time getting over the connection. Like one of the great things when I do my pop-ups at the dock is I'm out there cooking and I'm out there talking to people. And that to me is part of what owning a restaurant and cooking at a restaurant is all about. To Chef, I know you work the dining room in a way I can't ever, right? You could talk to every table. I am shy in that way. I know people find that hard to believe, but your whole life is working that dining room, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what I mean by, I think once this thing is over, I think people are very much, I mean, I like to go to see my customer, but I think my customer also like to be in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the part that would become challenging if you just put all your money in just Ghost Kitchen. I'm not sure how that works. Again, I think there is room for it, definitely now. And many of the things that we have done and gone through and pivoted towards in the last year are going to stay. But I'm not sure that it's going to stay in its size of, like, you know, covering 50 states at once. I'm not sure that's necessarily true. So I don't know. I have no idea about that part. But I do know that people are dying to go out to dinner, lunch, breakfast. They're missing their watering hole.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Amy, we're going to ask our listeners to play a part in this and letting me know not only what they think about it, but maybe experiences they've had with it. And if they do, I'm going to set aside a jar of my Rubbed Love smoked paprika, which I think is a delicious ingredient to use in lots of different dishes, out at the warehouse. So we'll put there, when you go to our, where do they go, our Facebook page?
Facebook at Hot Stove Show Radio. If you comment on the post, we will have a free jar of Rub at the warehouse at Sirius Takeout in Ballard starting on Monday.
Right. And it costs $10, well, $8 or so to ship the rub. That's why I'm not shipping it to you. But come on by, and we'll just hand you a free jar of the rub if you commented. And we'll have your the list of comments and your names set aside there at the warehouse.
Yeah.
So looking forward to that. I'm curious. I have never ordered from a ghost kitchen.
Neither have I.
The only place that I've... I only order eat at my own restaurant from that perspective. And I guess when I order from Thai Tung or when I order from Thai Siam or when I order from our own restaurants, Sirius Pie, I go pick it up. There's no delivery service in the middle of it all. And I still make that connection with the restaurant in my head and physically by picking it up myself.
Yeah. Me too. We've had very little delivery to my house. Yeah. If we're going to splurge on takeout, we go get it.
You go get it. And it's still, it's not the same, but it's a little bit part of the process.
Yeah, you're getting in your car and driving somewhere.
All right. Yeah. All right, Brittany, it's your turn next. It's the Baker's Corner, and we're going to talk winter citrus on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's time for the Baker's Corner here in the Hot Stove Society. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Jerry Rotero, the chef in the hat.
And Chef Brittany Bartolabin is here from Met Markets. Brittany, this is the time of year. I know you love walking through the produce department at Met to kind of decide what your company should be doing with their produce at any given time. And the last time I saw you super excited was during the big apple harvest in the fall. And you were talking all about apples and the smell of the apples as you walk through the produce department, that kind of being overwhelming. And what's getting your fancy right now?
Oh, the citrus. This is the best time of year for citrus, better than any other time. And it's perfect timing because it's so dreary out.
I know. Yeah. That's what's lovely about it. But is it really?
Yes.
Is winter, are winter grapefruits better than summer grapefruits?
Absolutely they
are. Okay, so why is it? Just because we have nothing else to choose from? They taste better?
It's the growing season.
Oh, it's the growing season.
Yeah, it's a tropical fruit, and this is when they're at their best.
Okay.
And just the sheer variety of it all. There's so much. And even, so I had a chat with our produce specialist at Met Market. Even the lemons alone, something you can get year round, they're usually fine. The lemons alone are at their juiciest. They're all seedless. So this is the time to even buy a bunch of lemons and make lemon curd. Mm-hmm. But that aside, the variety of all the cool stuff we've got coming. Next Friday, the 15th, will be our first delivery of sumo mandarins. Mm-hmm. These have sort of become, at first they were sort of like a cult thing.
Yeah.
But now that like everybody knows about them.
And those are the big kind of wrinkly, ugly, big.
Yes, enormous. They've got the little knot on top. They're easy to peel and they're like a giant satsuma.
Yeah, they look like me.
Very much so. I didn't want to say it. As a baker, normally I'm trying to do all sorts of cool things with these citrus fruits. Sumo mandarins are something I do nothing to. There's nothing I can do to a sumo mandarin to make it better. You just eat it. But, you know, there's also Caracara oranges, which are very delicious. They're pink, so they're pretty. They're always pretty on a plated dessert.
Those started showing up about 5 years ago, and they have become very popular.
Yes, I mean, not only are they pretty, but they're a great orange. Uh-huh. Some of these, there's some things that are just, you know, decorative. They don't taste that good. But these are truly delicious. What we've got coming up also is the gold nugget mandarin. I don't know if you've heard of these, but this is what our produce specialist says. It will be one of the top five things you will eat this year.
Really?
They're that good.
You know what I like to do with, like, going back to the caracaras or a blood orange or something like that? I like to thinly slice them whole, but thinly slice them all the way across, and I put them in the bottom of a big saute pan, and I put sugar in with them, and then I just caramelize them right in the bottom of the pan. And then once they are kind of tender, I put a layer of papriza on top and kind of make a Karakara tartatan type thing.
Yeah.
And they turn out beautifully.
They're so gorgeous. And I think the upside down dessert, an upside down cake, anything like that, people don't think of turning to citrus for that. They think citrus, they think curd and marmalade, which we'll talk about marmalade in a minute. But it's the skin, which people are afraid of eating or think they'll be too pithy and bitter, that completely mellows out in the sugar and in the cooking process. And it just a beautiful dessert.
I think that's the big part, is that people think they have to peel it.
Absolutely.
And these are literally just sliced across the whole orange.
Yeah.
Chef, have you tried that before?
Yes. And I love playing with lemon. Lemon, which is usually, pretty, obviously, the skin is usually pretty hard or pretty, not that pretty to eat, except when you zest. If you slice the lemon just like you do your blood orange, Tom, just across, and I do a mixture of sweet and sour of rice vinegar, sugar, and a few, if I have lemon verbena leaves, I put them in there too, and cook that super gently with parchment paper on top for a couple of hours, very, very slowly. And then you take this meat, and like Brittany's saying, upside down cake with that, or in a curd, if you make a lemon curd and you dice all that sweet and sour lemon and you put that in the curd, it really enhances the whole flavor. And put that in the bottom of a tart shell, or even by itself, in a bowl, and serve that with some whipped cream. And maybe some graham cracker on top, so you have like a mini lemon curd cheesecake kind of idea.
You said something key there, and that is cook it very slowly. That's really important anytime you're cooking. Even if you're making marmalade, citrus will scorch very easily. But if you're cooking, say you're making candied peels or you're candying some kumquats, which you do not have to do. You can eat kumquats whole.
They are tart.
I've seen people pop them in their mouth like grapes. It's not for me. I like them sliced and gently cooked in a syrup. But slow and low, and just let your kitchen fill with the beautiful aroma. Mm-hmm.
Another trick is to put it in the oven in a deep pan. Put it in the oven overnight, with your pilot light on. Mm-hmm. It cooks very, very slowly. The thing is, you don't want to boil citrus when you're cooking them, because it brings more bitterness out.
Exactly.
It breaks down the whole meat. So you want to keep them shaped, try to keep them whole.
I think I'm too much of a control freak to put it in the oven. I like to watch,
you like to watch it.
I like to watch it happen. Okay. Speaking of kumquats, I think it's going to be around the 22nd of this month. We have a ton of kumquats coming in. They're calling it their quat promo. And we've got some kumquats I've never heard of. I didn't know there was a mandarin quat. This is a new hybrid. So they're larger. We have a lime quat coming. And these are things I've never really seen in a traditional grocery store.
Right.
They're going to have calamansi, which I'm just thrilled about. Calamansi is one of my favorites. Citrus fruits.
I don't know what it is.
It's a hybrid between a kumquat and a mandarin. And one of the last desserts I had on the Dahlia, it was on the menu when we closed, was a calamansi layer cake. And it was just so exciting to me to have that ingredient available to work with. And they're sweet, and there's just a really unique flavor to them that it's used a lot in Filipino cooking. Mm. But it's just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And Brittany, do you ever use finger lime?
Finger lime. Yeah, those are cool. Those are really cool. I don't know that I would do anything with them other than let the cells pop out and, garnish a dessert with them or just eat them like that. But, boy, those are tasty.
Yeah, no, that's what I would do. Yeah. I would push it on top of a curd.
Yeah. Yeah,
that would be delicious.
Yeah.
Those are really delicious. If you can put your hand on that. My mother-in-law happens to have a big bush in the front yard of finger lime, and I got a whole bag of it. I was so excited.
I have to mention marmalade, because I think marmalade is a lost art. Not enough people make marmalade. It's so easy. And I think people are intimidated by it for some reason. I think what scares people is not cooking it long enough. And you have to cook it to the right temperature. It has to go to 220 degrees or it won't set. But you can make marmalade out of literally any citrus fruit.
Is there enough pectin in citrus that if you take it to that temperature, that you don't need to add pectin?
Correct. That's
That's the
Having said that, I have made marmalades where I jumped the gun a little bit and pulled it off the stove and went to use it the next day and it was too runny.
Mm-hmm.
I cheated. I added a little bit of pectin to it and it's fine. You would never know. So there is a save you can do if it doesn't set, but it's just not traditional marmalade if you do that. Mm-hmm. Marmalade is not thickened with pectin. And the hardest part about marmalade is just prepping your fruit. It's all that chopping work, but to me, I find to be kind of zenful. Put on a podcast, put on Hot Stove Radio.
There you go. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and so it's just, you know, washing your citrus really well, getting all the wax off of there. Some people sit there and slice the lemons or whatever you're using paper thin. I don't. I quarter the orange or whatever citrus I'm working with, rip out the fruit, and then thinly slice the skin. So that way it's just easier to get your knife through.
And what do you do with the fruit?
I just mash it up. You can roughly chop it. You can robo-coo it or put it in the food processor.
But it does go back in.
It does go back in. And then you just add water, cook it till it's soft, then add sugar, cook it to 220 degrees, bada bing, bada boom.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, in something like that, I'm always wanting to put an herb or, as Terry said, lemon verbena some complimentary. What do you like to use in there? Because I know mint. I love mint, but it turns black, and it's not very pretty.
I would stay away from the herbs for a marmalade, just exactly what you said. It doesn't preserve as beautifully. Ginger's a really great one to add if you want to pump it up a little bit. A satsuma ginger marmalade, can you imagine?
Yeah. A little pepper. A little white pepper.
White pepper, sure. Yeah, yeah. A spice, cinnamon stick, a vanilla bean. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Delicious. Mm. Yeah.
And then if you wanted to take that marmalade and make a quick little marmalade tart, what would you do there?
I would turn to my trusty almond cream, which would be almond paste, egg, butter, and sugar, and mix that into that almond cream.
Mix the marmalade into the almond cream, not make it a layer.
No. And then pour that into your tart, bake it, maybe with some, like you mentioned, some poached sliced citrus on top of it. Lovely.
Mm.
Yeah.
That is a good winter project for someone right there. And if you want to know more about that particular tart, just ask Brittany on Facebook, and we'll send you as close as we can to a recipe for that idea. Because I love that. Because I'm always ending up buying marmalades because I love them, but then I end up with half jars of marmalade in my fridge all the time. And it makes a quick dessert.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think people think about it. They think they have to put it on toast.
No, absolutely not. On ice cream? So good.
Really? I've never done that. Yeah. Marmalade on ice cream.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah.
All right, up next, it's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Chef Terry Rotereau has thrown the gauntlet at Miss Barbara Laban from his home in Madison Valley. And I would never say the kind of things
you said before you got here.
Yeah,
you're very gracious, competitive.
We'll be right back to the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Show. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. This Tasty Trivia is brought to you by Rub With Love. Handcrafted, versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards from my kitchen that add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable. Look for Rub With Love products in your local grocery stores, at Bartels, at your butcher shops. Find them online at Tom Douglas, as well as many other places. But check out Rub With Love spice rubs. They are fabulously delicious. Amy Richardson, what do you have for us now?
All right. Today's Tasty Trivia, we are playing for our girl Linda Stanley, who turned in her lovely recipe on today's show, and she is going to be winning a ginger pineapple teriyaki sauce, spicy Tokyo rub, salmon rub, and a veggie rub.
Ooh.
And the loser is going to pay for shipping.
That would be Chef Rotereau, right?
Yeah, we'll see.
You're going to pay for shipping today, it sounds like, according to Amy.
All right, Brittany, you are up first. All right, okay, we're doing all multiple choice.
Okay.
What small but mighty superfood can delay short-term memory loss?
Mm.
Sesame seeds, grapes, blueberries, or lentils?
Blueberries.
You are correct.
Yay.
All right.
Are they all going to be this easy for her, or sesame seeds,
hopefully,
really?
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Amy and I talked before. Yeah, she said she was going to give me an easy question.
All right, Britt, what is a tangelo? Is it a cross between a tangerine and a lemon? A cross between a tangerine, lemon, grapefruit, a cross between a tangerine and an orange, or a cross between a tangerine and a grapefruit?
I'm going to say the last one.
Woo-hoo!
Nice okay. guess.
One typical egg dish of New Orleans is this one created by Antoine's Restaurant. It consists of a bed of creamed spinach, artichoke hearts, poached eggs, all covered in hollandaise sauce. What is this divine creation? Egg sardou, eggs hussard, eggs benedict, or eggs St. Charles?
Well, it's not eggs benedict.
I will remind you, Brittany, that they wouldn't let me sit down in their restaurant. They booted me. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So think about that when you think about the name of this dish.
I'm terribly sorry, Amy. Can you tell me what the first two and the last one was? Yep. Whatever the ones that weren't eggs benedict.
Yep, we have egg sardou, eggs hussard, or eggs St. Charles.
Let's say the second one.
Ooh, it is egg sardou. Sorry, Britt.
And they booted you out, Tom?
Yeah, I walked in. I had a reservation, and then
were you not dressed appropriately?
They looked at me. They kind of looked at me, starting at my eyes, and then they looked down all the way
shorts?
Down to my shoes, and then all the way back up to my eyes, and say, you're not welcome here.
I will not forget that.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So silly.
I tell you, the last time that happened to me, just a quick aside, was at the Crescent Hotel. The what's that famous restaurant in Dallas? With the tall chef.
Mansion of Turtle Creek.
So the maitre d' just dressed me down like, what are you doing here without a tie? So I went out to the parking lot, paid the parking lot attendant $20 for his tie, and walked right back in and just gave that guy, said, here's my tie, and cancel my reservation.
So this happens to you regularly, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. What was the first cheese added to the Philly cheesesteak? Cheese sauce, mozzarella slices, provolone, or two American cheese slices?
Cheese sauce.
Oh, you are incorrect.
Oh!
Provolone in 1949.
Yeah.
Isn't it now served with cheese sauce?
Yes.
Okay.
That's why it's embarrassing. That's why my Delaware Avenue cheesesteak pop-up is not going to have cheese sauce.
Oh, okay.
All right. How many crimps should a Cornish pasty have? 33, 27, 20, or 40?
I don't know. Let's go 27.
Oh, so close. It's 20. All right, Britt, you have 2 out of 5.
Oh, that's terrible. Terrible showing.
Okay, Terry, are you ready?
I'm ready. Okay. Go ahead.
We're doing multiple choice. Which superfood contains more antioxidants, gram for gram, than most fruit juices? Dark chocolate, flaxseed, seaweed, or almonds?
Dark chocolate.
Correct. Okay, which NOLA cocktail first created in 1888 includes egg whites on one of its key ingredients? A brandy milk punch, a mint julep, lemon drop, or Ramon gin fizz?
Ramon gin fizz.
Whoop, whoop.
Wow, he was right. He is going to crush you today,
uh-oh.
Brittany.
Really is.
According to folklore, which dish takes its name from a phrase meaning throw something together? Etouffee, gumbo, jambalaya, or muffaladas?
I'm going to go with jambalaya.
Wow, correct, Terry.
Jeez, look at him.
Yeah, 3 for 3.
Which snack food is native to Philadelphia? Klondike bars, pork rinds, tasty cakes, or Twinkies?
Twinkie.
Incorrect. Tasty cakes.
Butterscotch crumpets. That's my favorite.
Don't
tasty
bother, cake. Eat a rail.
Yeah, these aren't something you would ever buy in your whole life, Chef.
I know. I kind of put that in there.
That's what you get for being a snob, a food snob.
Adding this ingredient to a Cornish pasty would be a sin. Spinach, cabbage, carrots, or mushrooms?
That's a good question. Yeah.
Carrots.
Correct.
Carrots?
Correct.
Really?
I would have said
they
spinach.
They are too sweet.
They're too sweet. Mm-hmm. Wow, who knew?
All right, Thierry, you got 4 out of 5.
Wow.
Hey, that's a good comeback.
Yeah,
good
nice comeback. Job.
All right, Tommy D, which of the following drinks would you consider a superfood? Cranberry juice, water, red wine, or decaf coffee?
Cranberry juice.
Ooh, it's water.
Is a superfood?
It's a superfood.
Ah.
A Blenheim orange is what type of fruit? An orange, strawberry, pear, or apple?
A Blenheim orange is what
type of fruit? An orange, strawberry, pear, or apple?
I'm going to go with apple.
Correct. Okay, which ingredient are you likely to find in Creole dishes but not Cajun dishes? Peppers, pork, shrimp, or tomatoes?
I'm going to go tomatoes.
Correct. An unusual use that has been suggested for Cheese Whiz is stain remover, car polish, a thickening agent, or antacid?
Well, exactly my point of why Philadelphia should give up the title of cheesesteak capital of the world, because they put whiz on everything, and it's better as a car polish.
Ooh, close. Stain remover.
Yeah, exactly.
Apparently, if you rub it on clothes and then wash as usual, the cheese whiz helps remove a grease stain.
Mm. Hmm. What a shocker.
I want some on my cheese steak.
All right, last question. In Cornwall, how should you top a scone? Jam, then cream, then jam, or butter, jam, then cream?
Option three.
Close. Jam, then cream.
Yeah. All right, so Chef in the Chapeau, despite his pneumonia, is the clear winner today.
And Brittany, I'm sorry you're paying for shipping.
And you know, shipping on four units like that is about $10. So you better start. Saving up.
Yep.
Okay. if you want to join us at any time on the show, you can join the community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Of course, today's lucky winner won a jar of ginger pineapple teriyaki sauce by Rub With Love, spicy Tokyo rub, salmon rub, and veggie rub. So a three pack. You know, I don't know if you know this, Amy, but the Tokyo rub and the ginger pineapple teriyaki, classic combination, just so you know. You're listening to us on the Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. This show is produced by Amy Richardson. Our friend Madeline has moved on to her new job at Seattle Academy. We miss her terribly already. Our sound and production is by Sean McFadden, and our editor is Sean, don't call me, Del Torre. Remember, if you miss any episode of our Hot Stove Society show on Cairo 97.3, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. I wanted to remind you,
Thanks. Come
join me at the cheesesteak pop-up on Inauguration Day. And, of course, for our New Orleans boxes coming up this next week and class here at the Hot Stove. I'm Tom Douglas, and I bid you adieu. Chef, it's great to have you back on the show, huh?
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for listening. We love you much.
All right. Thanks, Brittany.
No problem. Thanks for having me.